It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you've ever moved to a new place before, you know those first few months can be a tough transition. We'll get advice on getting to know the place you live with the author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. First, in California, there are still wildfires burning, new ones starting, and the season is just really getting rolling. It's been a bad fire season already after what seems like a lot of bad fire seasons. Our next guest says it's time for a fundamental look at humankind's relationship with fire, and we need to figure out how to live with wildfires sometimes as we enter the pyrocene, the age of fire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the wildfires this year? What thoughts or questions do you have about how we manage fires? Have your views of big fires changed over the last several years? Have you ever lived in a place where wildfires were part of your daily reality? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen J. Pine is Professor Emeritus at Arizona State University. He's written several books on fire, its history and management, including Fire, A Brief History. His latest is called The Pyrocene, How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
You take a long view on fire. And one of the sort of earth-shaking things that I learned when I read your book is we didn't really have fire on this planet until we had life and particular kinds of life. Can you talk about the relationship between fire and living organisms on this planet?
Yeah, that's a great point. Fire is a creation of the living world. I mean, life created the oxygen it needs. Life on land created the fuels and arranges them. And eventually, life in the form of us provides most of the ignition. And that, in some ways, comes as a surprise because our sense of fire is so deeply embedded in our machines, appliances we make, controlling combustions. Even the dictionary definition thinks of it as a physical chemical reaction, but it's actually a biochemical reaction. Fire takes apart what photosynthesis puts together. When it occurs in our cells, we call it respiration. When it occurs in the open landscape, we call it fire. So it's been around as long as plants have been on continents. We have fossil charcoal that dates back over 420 million years.
We think sometimes of wildfires in particular as this outside force of destruction. You write that in many ecosystems, it is a regular part of the natural world that evolved in some ways along with the life forms that evolved in an ecosystem. How do we change that mindset to think of fire as part of these systems, not as an alien force?
Well, another good question. Part of it is that most of us in the industrial world, and urban industrial world especially, don't deal with open fire anymore. I mean, even at my university, students were prohibited from having candles in their dorm rooms. We found ways to substitute for it. So it's out of our life. Up until 30 years ago, we didn't really have even a science of fire ecology to understand it. It had just disappeared. So it can be problematic for people to understand how it functions. We see it today mostly vicariously, or we see it up front in the form of disasters. But one of the paradoxes we're dealing with is that these mega fires that have proved so disastrous and are continuing in California now are really a pathology of the developed world. They're something that's been created by trying to take fire out of the natural system or modifying it within the context of living landscapes. By that I mean humans have always manipulated fire. I mean, back to our hominin ancestors, you know, and there's a good argument that we got small guts and big heads because we learned to cook food. And then we went to the top of the food chain because we learned to cook landscapes. We've been doing this a long time, but it always came within checks and balances that are embedded in living ecosystems. You know, you overdo it, you shorten the return interval, you do it too much under the wrong conditions, then things deteriorate and you're forced to withdraw. The real transition comes when we begin burning what I've taken to call lithic landscapes, that is, once living, now fossilized landscapes in the form of coal, natural gas, petroleum, and so forth. And this kind of combustion in our hands has no boundaries. It can burn day or night, winter or summer. Seasons don't matter. It can burn wet or dry. So all of the old checks and balances that forced us to negotiate with the living landscape around us in our use of fire, our species monopoly use of fire, I might add, are gone. And suddenly the question is no longer finding more stuff to burn and ways to burn it. The problem is what to do with all the emissions and effluent from it. And we're now, you know, unhinging the atmosphere, the oceans, destabilizing biotas. In my sense, that when you add up all of these kinds of ways that our fire practices in both living and lithic landscapes, add them all up, we're creating the fire equivalent of an ice age, complete with mass extinctions, changes in sea level, large biogeographic shifts, and so forth.
We're talking to Stephen Pine about his new book, The Pyrocene, How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hello.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I did have kind of a two-part comment, but the guest already addressed kind of, in a sense, my first part, which was about climate change. But the second reason I was calling is just to say my grandparents have some land in near Spring Green, Wisconsin, and for the last 10 or so years, my family and I have been helping do some controlled prairie burns down there to do some prairie restoration of wildflowers and the like. And it's been a really interesting and fun experience, and I've learned a lot. But just seeing even just prairie in a controlled burn, the intensity and the speed of fire like that can be really terrifying. And you can feel it from way further away than you would even think was possible.
Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Stephen, can you talk about that? One of the tools you recommend at the end of your book is going to be humans controlling fires in selected environments, starting them on purpose, but limiting them. In this case, it's a controlled prairie burn.
Well, it's almost impossible to maintain tall grass prairie without fire. If you remove fire, woody species move in very quickly, and then you have to mechanically clear them or do other things to get fire back in. And that's been known for some time, and there are other ecosystems like that. It sounds like the fires the caller is setting were pretty intense. They may not need to be so intense. Historically, people would begin burning grasslands and marshlands and others very early in the dry season. So the fires were not, you know, like a stampede of bison going through the plains. They were more like a swarm of mice chewing their way through. So you can vary the character and the timing and seasonality of fires. And you get different effect when you do that. And that's what people have always done. That's what we do uniquely. That's our ecological signature. No other creature does it. So we've sort of forgotten that and gone into our machines, and that certainly has its place, but applied to landscapes, it has been largely disastrous.
Can you talk about the possibility of that kind of controlled burn carefully in the right season in places that are wildfire prone if the fire happens in the wrong season?
Well, sure. I mean, we can look at California. It's well documented that before Europeans arrived, well, how do we know it was documented? It was after Europeans arrived. But there are plenty of accounts which show the indigenous peoples of California burning very widely probably two or three times as much as last year's wildfires took in California. But they were doing it, they would do it early in the season. They would find a dry patch and burn it. And then that burned area would then become an anchor point for an adjacent patch when that dried out. And so you keep moving your way around. You may burn up against the snow as it retreats up the snow line. You may burn against wet areas as lakes and ponds recede and with the dry season. And then you keep working this sort of fluid jigsaw puzzle, and you've got most of the area burned by the time lightning fire becomes a possibility. So there are lots of ways, and there are good reasons for looking back in the past. How is it that, you know, humanity survived for a couple hundred thousand years using fire, living in fire-prone areas without destroying themselves? They didn't do it the way we're doing it. And so there are a lot of things we can learn from that. We won't be doing the same stuff with the same techniques, same technologies, but we can certainly adapt it to modern conditions. And there are people doing that. And it's happening in other places. Australia is experimenting with this as well, and parts of Canada.
We're talking with Steve Pine, Professor Emeritus at Arizona State University, about his new book, The Pyrocene: How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about wildfires, about the way humans relate to and use fire? Have you lived in an area that experienced lots of wildfires, or do you have people living next to one right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Steve Pine, Professor Emeritus at Arizona State University, about his new book, The Pyrocene: How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about fires, wild or otherwise, that's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our caller, Steve, I wanted to ask about this anniversary coming up in the Midwest, 150 years in just a week or two since the same day the Great Peshtigo Fire, a wildfire that destroyed Peshtigo, Wisconsin, a number of other smaller communities, and same day the Great Chicago Fire, an urban fire that destroyed a lot of Chicago. And it seems like once upon a time, living in a city meant you dealt with fires. It was just a thing. And we seem to have really changed that. What happened? How are we so, I think, successful in stopping that kind of, especially that kind of Chicago fire?
Yeah. Well, you know, Chicago at that time was basically a reconstituted forest. It was made out of the same materials that Peshtigo and the surrounding environments were. And it burned exactly like a forest fire under the same passing cold front, so the same meteorological systems. And gradually, after really San Francisco in 1906, large urban fires disappear. We took steps for zoning, we took steps for fire codes, building standards, building materials, plus a rather elaborate infrastructure for firefighting. And fires had more or less disappeared until they started returning in the last two or three decades, actually beginning across from San Francisco and Oakland in 1990 when they made the first big announcement. And now it's become routine. Well, what has happened? Well, in a way, we quit doing all the things that had taken fire out of these systems. And part of it, we've defined the issue as a wildland-urban interface. It's a really geeky kind of dumb term, boiled out of California in the mid-80s. But it was defined by the wildland people who were worried about houses coming in on what were essentially forests and shrublands. And instead, that turned out to be complicated to deal with. Instead, we could have picked up the other end of that stick and said, these are basically urban fires with funny landscaping. If we had done that, it's pretty obvious you have to do to prevent these communities from burning. You treat them like little patches of cities, and you impose the same kinds of order on it that we did in larger urban areas. So now we've got a problem and a lot of retrofitting to do, and it's going to be awkward and expensive. But the good news is that we had done it before, and we can do it again. We know how. In the same way, Peshtigo started off an age, 50 years, megafires, in many ways an order of magnitude larger and more lethal than what we've seen recently. And that also suggests we can deal with it if we choose to.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, Steele in Appleton, who wondered how many of the wildfires we're seeing, the initial cause can be pinned on some kind of arson, an intentionally set fire, versus other, I guess, man-made accidental causes, or, as you mentioned earlier, those lightning strikes.
Well, the proportion of lightning in human depends where you are, how much lightning is. It's not even just a number of lightning. It's whether the lightning occurs in kind of a dry climate. But arson fires are pretty small. They arouse lots of attention for obvious reasons. In fact, it seems that one currently going in Northern California has been identified as arson. The most lethal ones in recent years have been power lines because they fail in high winds. Exactly the time when a fire, if it's arc, gets started, it's going to blow out of control before we can contain it. So most of the fires that threaten communities are human caused, directly or indirectly. Probably only 2 or 3% are coming from further out and from lightning. Arson, one of the ways to stop arson, though, let me back up. Power of fire resides in the power to propagate. It spreads. And the way to remove that power from fire is prevent it from spreading. And that you do by controlling the larger landscape. And there are lots of ways to do it. You don't have to nuke it or pave it. There are lots of things we can do. And that is a way to take the power of arson fire away. It simply won't be able to do the damage it would if that landscape were in a more fire-prone, more fire-explosive condition.
We're talking to Steve Pine about his new book, The Pyroscene, How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. Let's go back to your calls now. John is with us in Ashland. John, hi.
Hi. One very quick story and one question. I had a friend who, when he became an adult, he confessed once that as a little kid, he didn't see much of his dad, who was a firefighter. And so he used to deliberately set fires near the house so that he could see his dad. I mean, that blew me away. But the question I had was, President Trump had talked about cleaning the forest floor, and that's why we have these fires in California. And then I read later that people actually do thin out forests. It creates less of a possibility of fire igniting. Can you address that and whether that, in fact, sure, takes place?
Sure. No, there are lots of things. Our forests are not in good shape, most of them, particularly in the West. A lot of this actually began in the 19th century with overgrazing, which took the grasses out that had routinely carried fire and then gave rise to thickening woods that came in. Now, this was 20, 30 years before the Forest Service even came on the scene. And then logging introduced enormous amounts of slash. And that is what powered the Peshtigo Fire and this cycle, 50-year cycle of megafires, mostly around the Great Lakes and the northern border with Canada, and actually across the lakes in Canada. So there's plenty of evidence for that. More recently, the issue has been one of having removed fire. Our forests were often in bad shape. Fire was seen as a contributor to that problem. They sought to remove fire, but then they never realized they needed to put it back in another form again. So the forests have come to assume a shape that makes fires more eruptive, makes it difficult to contain them, and can make them burn more severely than they would have otherwise. There are lots of things you can do to restore that. There's a kind of thinning process. We're not talking about logging, taking big stuff. We're talking about taking the small stuff, which is really what fire burns. And it's a kind of woody weeding, thinning that out, reintroducing fire, both of which can be relatively benevolent ways of getting a landscape into a form where we can control the bad fires that we don't want and promote the good fires that we do. So there are many, many varieties of things we can do. You could also reintroduce beavers, for example, in places. They create wet fire breaks. Other places, you may want, you could reintroduce prairie dogs in parts of the Great Plains. They produce fire breaks. There are all kinds of sort of ecological things you can do to improve it. Grazing and browsing animals can be important. There are places where goats and sheep can be used, again, under prescribed conditions. So there are many things, and most places will require a suite of treatment, a cocktail of treatments adapted to their particular circumstances.
John, thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Steve, how important is trying to rein in climate change to preventing ranges of fires from expanding to places where we're not used to them, tough fire seasons where we are used to them?
Sure. There are a lot of treatments we can do to mitigate the crises that are evolving around us. But ultimately, we have to get a handle on climate change or it will override all of the other things we could do. So I see us doing a bunch of things to keep cities and communities from burning. That could be done in a handful of years if we really chose. We can get our landscapes in better shape within a handful of decades. Climate change will be longer, but we need to do all of them at the same time.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay.
That's Stephen Pine. Stephen Pine, Professor Emeritus at Arizona State University. We talked to him about his new book called The Pyroscene, How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. Coming up after the news, when you move to a new community, what does it take to become a local? That's a new question from our Why Sconcin project, and our guest has answers from going for walks to meeting your neighbors and more. And you can share your thoughts starting right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and tell us if there was a moment after moving to a community where you felt like, yeah, I belong here. Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Moving to a new place can be hard. You don't know your way around town. Maybe you're far away from friends and family. Charles Robert McIvey recently moved to the Madison area and submitted a question through WPR's Why Sconcin project. Charles asked, how does one become a local? What do people need to know to acclimate? Those are questions our next guest has spent a lot of time thinking about. She's got some strategies for putting down roots and loving where you live. Wherever that is, we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How long does it take you to feel comfortable after moving to a new place? What things help you feel more at home? Do you feel like you have a sense of community where you live, no matter how long you've lived there? Have you moved a lot? Is it tough to get rooted in a new place? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Melody Warnick is author of the book, This is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, If You Could Live Anywhere, The Surprising Importance of Place in a Work from Anywhere World. Melody, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you write in your book that you've had a lot of experience moving from place to place in your adult life. What is it that finally hit you that, hey, in this place I am right now, I'm going to make an effort to become a local and put down some roots?
So my family had just moved from Austin, Texas, to a small college town in Southwest Virginia. My husband had gotten a new job at the university, and my kids were starting fifth grade and kindergarten. and I absolutely hated it there, did not feel at home, but recognized that we were probably going to be here for the long haul. My pattern before that was just to keep moving, you know, keep looking for the next best place. And finally, in this little town of Blacksburg, Virginia, I thought, I need to learn how to feel at home here right now. I can't just wait until we move again. And so that started me on this journey of trying to figure out what it takes for people to feel at home in a new community or an old one, and what kinds of actions we can take to facilitate that process for ourselves quickly.
And this is a big mindset change for you and people who you write about who are more movers as opposed to stayers. The idea that happiness is the next move away. Happiness is the next place I go versus happiness is here if I work to find it. How hard was it to make that mental change?
I think that's something that a lot of us love to think that, you know, I have problems here in this current place. I don't always like my neighbors or my job is tough. But if I move to that new place, I get that clean slate and everything is going to be better. I think of that as the geographic cure, this idea that we're just going to find a new city and all our problems are magically going to be solved and we're going to be the best version of ourselves. So it definitely was a shift to start thinking of, instead of waiting for my place to fix me, thinking of how can I be happy here no matter what's going on in my life. And that's kind of what I really discovered about this concept of place attachment. Place attachment is this idea that we can feel an emotional connection, sort of a relationship with the place where we live. And like any kind of relationship, it takes a while to develop and it takes some work. But once we put down those roots and we establish that connection, it can be really meaningful and really beneficial in our lives.
Here we have this Wisconsin question from our listener, Charles, new to, in this case, Madison, Wisconsin. What is the first step you recommend for someone like Charles to start to get to know a new place?
So I think Charles found the first step on his own, and that's actually realizing that he might have to do something to become a local. I love the question, how does one become a local? Because I think a lot of times we move and we just think that this is going to happen automatically for us. And Charles at least knows that he might have to do some work here, which I think is great. But I would break it down into a three-pronged approach of people, places, and participation, you know, building connections and relationships with other people, finding places that make you happy, and then last, starting to participate, starting to feel a sense of ownership over your place. So for Charles, I would say the number one thing that's going to make him feel more comfortable quicker is to start building human connections with the people around him. When you're moving to a new town, it can be really lonely, and that can be really overwhelming. You miss the place that you moved from. So the faster Charles or anyone else who's new in a town can sort of find their people, find their community, the better off you are. And that can happen in a lot of ways. It could be, you know, joining a rec league soccer team or finding a church you want to go to or volunteering, finding some place where people who have your same interests are congregating. I like to think that a really easy way to start this is to get to know your neighbors. Tomorrow, September 28th, actually happens to be National Good Neighbor Day. It's a great chance and a good excuse to just go say hello to your neighbors, take them, you know, some muffins or something, but establish some connections with the people who live around you. It makes you feel more connected fast.
Talking to Melody Warnick, author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are, and the forthcoming, If You Could Live Anywhere. She's helping answer a question about how to feel like a local, how to become a local after moving to a new community. You can share your answers to that question at 800-642-1234. How did you settle into a new place after moving? Or do you feel like you haven't become a local? You haven't found those connections yet. Do you need some encouragement? Or if you stay in one place, if you've lived in a place for a long time, how do you help welcome that new person? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Melody, let's stick with those neighbors now. Now, you mentioned finding common interests like at that church or the soccer league or whatever. Well, the neighbor is luck of the draw. How did you, in your move, build connections with your neighbors who you may or may not have had anything in common with?
So I didn't have anything in common with my neighbors. I write in the book about having a neighbor across the street that had these long dreadlocks and these ear gauges. And I'm, you know, classic middle-aged mom. And I just thought, oh, gosh, like, you know, what are we going to talk about? But I celebrated National Good Neighbor Day. I made some banana muffins and I took them over. And that was what I did. I took banana muffins around to the neighbors that I could see from my house. And the reaction was amazing. And I guess testifies to how seldom this happens. But this neighbor across the street with the dreadlocks was so bowled over to, to, you know, get these banana muffins, to have a neighbor approach him and say hi, that he started chatting. He had lived there far longer than we had. He knew the whole history of, you know, everyone who had lived in our house. And even though we didn't become BFFs after that, it became this sort of sweet relationship of, hey, we know each other and, you know, we have each other's backs. We did that for our next door neighbors. And there was a day when I was in an appointment that ran long and needed someone to help pick up one of my daughters, and neighbors were pinch hitting for me. So, you know, your neighbors might not become the people you hang out with all the time, but there are studies that show the more we know and trust our neighbors, not only the healthier we are, it has benefits for our health, makes us less likely to have a heart attack or stroke, but it also makes us feel that sense of happiness and, you know, feeling rooted in the place we are. So it's worth the effort, even if you say, I will never be friends with this person. It's worth it just to, you know, make that effort to say hello.
We're talking to Melody Warnick, author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. She's with us today to help answer a question we got from WPR's Why Wisconsin Project about how to get to know a new place after you move. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you, how did you make friends in a new city, a new town? Is it a struggle to put yourself out there at first? Do you wish there was a stronger sense of community where you live right now? Do you like going for walks where you live? Does that help you feel more connected? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about getting comfortable, getting connected in a new place after a move, and learning how to love the place you live. Melody Warnick stays with us, author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. This is a response to a Why Wisconsin question, looking to help somebody feel settled in a new community. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with getting used to a new place, finding a sense of community and connection where you live. What do you love about the place you live? Do you feel like a local, even if you're new there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Nancy on Facebook. Nancy writes, I realized I was truly a local when I started referring to places that don't exist anymore. It's by the old Kmart, across the street from the old Westwood School, and so on. I have that with restaurants that aren't there anymore, Melody. But that's, you know, that's something that takes time to get to. Can we jumpstart the process and shorten the time from moving to becoming that local?
Yeah, I love that comment because yeah. I've heard that that is exactly how you know you're a local in New York City, is you can name the last three stores that were in that location. I think, yes, we can shorten the time. So studies show that the average amount of time it takes to become really place attached and to put down those roots is about 3 years. And if you're new in a place and feeling kind of lonely and overwhelmed. 3 years feels like a really long time. So I think you can take action to follow steps that will make you feel more rooted faster. And that was my approach in Blacksburg, Virginia, when I realized I just don't really like it here. I just don't feel at home. I looked at what research said about what makes people feel more attached to their places, and I started doing that in my life. I called them love where you live experiments, and these were just kind of micro action steps that I or anyone could take to sort of strengthen that bond with your place. So some of the things I did were I started trying to become a local at a local restaurant. I shopped more often at independently owned stores. I walked more. I hiked in my area. I volunteered at the local nonprofit movie theater. And all of these things kind of slowly over time had the effect of helping me feel more at home. So there is a time component here. It does sometimes just take a few months or even a few years to really feel like you belong in a place. But I think we can speed it up for ourselves if we're intentional about building place attachment in a new home.
I want to key in on one of those that you just mentioned that I really love, walking in a community. And when I'm traveling, one of my favorite things about a new city is just going for big walks. What is it about walking in particular, as opposed to, say, driving around your community, that gets us more connected?
So studies show that when we drive everywhere, we have windscreen perspective, where all we see is kind of the buildings going by at 40 miles an hour. But when you walk, it's at a human pace that allows you to really observe your surroundings. And when you observe them, you start to feel a sense of ownership. This was one of the first things I did in Blacksburg when I moved here. And so it not only helped me just logistically learn my way around my neighborhood, but I started to see people. Things became familiar. I learned the names of some of the dogs in the neighborhood. And so it's just a way to kind of shrink your place, to feel a sense of ownership over it.
And you went further. You did some guerrilla marketing to try to encourage other people to walk and participated in this national project to put up fun signage. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there is a man named Matt Tomasulo in Raleigh, North Carolina, who realized that walking was one of the great ways that people could connect with their place. But in Raleigh, as in a lot of cities, just no one was doing it. Everyone would hop in their car for every journey. And so he made these signs, and he kind of just put them up, no permission, went out at night like a ninja and put these on lampposts, just saying things like, it's a 15-minute walk to the grocery store, it's a 10-minute walk to the park. And he called it Walk Your Place. And he made a way for anyone to make those kinds of signs for their town. And so I did that in Blacksburg, which is another part of what I think helps us feel connected with our place, not just walking, but making things happen in our town, creating something new. Sometimes we call this placemaking, just little actions we can take that make our place better. And so I put up these signs, and they stayed up for about 6 months. I got some comments about them, you know, signs pointing out a local nature center, or it's an 8-minute walk to a historic cemetery. And it was just kind of a way to encourage other people to do some of these love where you live experiments for themselves. I think there's lots of easy ways like that that we can have an impact on our environment and on the people around us that don't take a lot of time and effort, but really bear fruit in terms of our sense of place attachment.
Talking to Melody Warnick, author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are, getting strategies and tactics to help us feel like we're part of our community, whether we just moved there or if we've lived there a long time. Still time for your experiences at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Melody, I want to flip things around. Were there things that you got from locals in your community that, you know, the long-timers maybe, or the people who already lived there, that helped you or hindered you from feeling more connected?
Well, when I first moved here, I think the locals were one of the things that made it harder to feel at home. I remember going to the hardware store and feeling like I needed subtitles because the Southern accents were so thick. But one of the things I learned is that people who have lived in a community for a long time are the experts on the community, and they know better than anyone what there is to love about this place. So I learned this tip from someone else who was also new to Blacksburg, but I think it's a great idea for anyone. They would go to restaurants or the farmers market, and they would strike up conversations and ask people, what do you love about it here? And they made a town bucket list of things that they wanted to try that could be anything from, you know, the local duck pond on the university campus to a restaurant that's out of the way that maybe you weren't aware even existed. I think that is such a good suggestion for anyone who's new to a community and trying to feel at home there. Assume that the locals are the experts. They know all the cool stuff that you don't know. And talk to them and, you know, make a bucket list for yourself. What are the things that people come here to your town to do when they go on vacation? So I've been to Madison exactly once, but I have really fond memories of visiting the zoo and the lake and the farmers market and the botanical garden. So I think, you know, going back to Charles' question, mm-hmm. how do I become a local here? Start with those biggies for sure. But once you've crossed those off your list, start asking people, what are the things that people who live in Madison or any town that you live in, what do people love to do here? And then start doing them. I live in a college town. I regret to say, not a huge football fan, but I realize that football is big in my community, and that if I really wanted to become a local here, I was going to have to embrace it. And so it's my theory of do what your town is good at. Your town may not be good at the things you wish it was good at, but it is good at something. So figure out what that is and do it. And for me in Blacksburg, it was going to some Virginia Tech Hokie football games and embracing that experience. And doing stuff like that really helped me feel like I was part of things here.
Time for one quick call. Jonathan is with us in Madison. Jonathan, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about?
So, my wife and I just moved to Madison from Colorado. Before you ask why, it's for school. we've gotten that question from about 20 people as to why we moved from Colorado to Wisconsin, and it's school. But the first thing we did when we got here was find a dog park. You know, Madison has like 20, but we found the closest one to us, and we go like 3 or 4 times a week because we have a dog, and it's a great way to get outside. But then, you know, it's easy to be friendly at a dog park and get to know people. And when you're there that many times a week, you remember faces, and then you talk a lot. And we found, you know, 3 other dog parks that other people like to go to because they're specifically cool. There's one that just opened that's a beer garden and a dog park. And it's like, oh, that's a fantastic place to go hang out.
Jonathan, thanks so much for that call. And we'll give you the last word with some advice to Charles there. And Melody, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. It was great fun.
That was Melody Warnick. She's the author of the book, This Is Where You Belong, Finding Home Wherever You Are. She was with us today to answer a question we got from a WPR listener named Charles on our Wisconsin project about how to get used to and become a local in a new place. You can submit your question for Wisconsin, and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's W-H-Y-Sconsin. And hope to hear from you there, and maybe we'll tackle your question. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, as Wisconsin draws new voting maps, we'll check out the latest political twists and turns and legal twists and turns in court, in another court, and beyond. And Wisconsin has some solar power plans in the works, and we're not alone. We'll get the latest on renewable energy projects around the Midwest. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Last week on Central Time, we learned about the physical and mental health benefits of walking. Well, it turns out, as we just heard, it's good for getting to know your community, too. Well, it turns out it really is good exercise and good for our emotional and mental well-being. You can check out that conversation with an exercise expert and a psychologist in our archives at WPR.org. We ask you to share your walking stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here are a couple few of them. Deborah says she walks several times a week, Mondays with a group, weekends with grown-up children and the grandchildren. All vacations are nature-oriented and filled with walking, but the best, Deborah says, is solo, because I notice so much more when there are no distractions. My physical, emotional, and mental health are dependent on my jaunts into nature. As an excellent geology teacher once put it, Earth. It's a nice planet. I highly recommend it. Mary tells us, I usually walk twice a day, sometimes with a friend or my husband. Other times, I walk alone. When I walk alone, I sometimes listen to WPR. Other times, I listen to the sounds around me. And Kim tells us, I try to walk once a day for 35 to 45 minutes. I take the dog, no music, and we listen to the sounds around us. After about 10, 15 minutes in, I notice stress and tension leaving my body. My mind starts to relax. Nature can be so soothing. You can share your walking story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.